Welcome to Justice Visions, the podcast about everything that is new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org. Welcome to this new season of the Justice Visions podcast, in which we will continue to discuss developments in the domain of transitional justice. My name is Sangeeta Yogendran. I'm one of the researchers on the Justice Visions team, and I'm very excited to host this new season of the podcast. In this season, we're going to zoom in on our own research through the question of how do we talk about? We are going to draw in practitioners, victims, and other researchers into the conversation, and today we shed a light on justice efforts for Syrians with our colleague Brigitte Herremans, who is sitting here with me in the recording studio. So welcome, Brigitte.
Hello, Sangeeta.
So Brigitte, you're keen to talk about justice efforts for Syrians and make the case for opening what you call the justice imagination, sharing some insights from an article that you and Tina Distrupa have recently published on which justice efforts exist in the Syrian context, and also how can we open up the debate on what is possible. So if I can ask you here, why do you feel it's important to talk about this issue now?
Personally, I feel it's always important to talk about Syria because that's what I'm studying on a daily basis, and also because the impact of the conflict is heavily underestimated. Feasibility politics has really determined the way how we discuss this conflict and the way how we're dealing with the Assad regime. And this regime managed to crush the uprising and launched what I would call an annihilation campaign against the majority of its citizens. And this really numbed a lot of people.
In what sense, Brigitte, do you think it has numbed people?
Well, it has created this feeling that we have to put up with Assad, and it also overshadowed the justice debate. And of course, people don't wait for the end of the conflict or for Assad to leave to really start the pursuit of justice and accountability. And that's really why we wanted to spark the debate with this article among academics, ideally, but also, of course, with practitioners. And we've interviewed a couple of these practitioners on how they conceive justice efforts and also what the shortcomings are in the current climate.
That's great to hear. To demonstrate what these endeavors concretely are, you also spoke to Mariam Halak and Yasmin Feta. Mariam's son, Ayham, was forcibly disappeared and killed by the Assad regime, and she never retrieved his body. She is now the founder of the Caesar Families Association, gathering families who identified their missing relatives through a collection of photographs known as the Caesar File. Currently, she is based in Berlin. Yasmin Feta is an award-winning filmmaker from a Palestinian and Syrian background and lectures in film at Queen Mary University of London. She directed the documentary Ayuni, chronicling the story of media activist Basil Safadi and Italian priest Paolo, who were respectively disappeared and executed by the regime and kidnapped by ISIS. The film was released in February 2020, and it did not screen as widely as hoped because of COVID, but it can be watched online via the site of Ayuni. These must have been very rich conversations, Brigitte.
Yes, indeed. I really wanted to bring in Mariam and Yasmin because they want to overcome the absence of the disappeared and the missing. And through civil society activism on the one hand and artistic practices on the other hand, they really both in their own way make the voice of victims and survivors heard. And it's really hard to fathom how to stop injustices in that pitch black place that Syria currently is. And often outsiders, when I speak to them, they're very pessimistic about the potential and the value of justice initiatives. And in my understanding, this defeatism also overshadows and it even undermines the activism of activists, NGOs, and even formal institutions. Whereas they're putting daily justice on the international agenda.
This pessimism must be really hard for these justice actors. And the lack of accountability and also criminal proceedings must be devastating for survivors and victims.
Yes, indeed. And it also forces them to look for other avenues. And by zooming in on these particular projects of Mariam and Yasmin, I wanted to demonstrate that the right to truth is really of utmost importance for victims. And for example, Mariam, after a quest of almost 2 years, she wanted to find out about her son Ayham's fate. And her first and foremost demand is really to have a grave for her son. Mm-hmm. And Yasmin, she wants to demonstrate how forcible disappearances and kidnappings are often used to silence people. She wants to counter this by presenting those who are missing.
That was really interesting information to learn about. But if I can maybe take a step back before we dive into these complex topics of overcoming absences, erasure, and invisibilization, could you provide us with some background on the Syrian conflict? What are currently the most important obstacles to justice?
Well, of course, at the heart of the problem lies the lack of political will. And there's an international stalemate, of course, that is reflected by the Russian and Chinese veto in the UN Security Council, and that blocks a referral to the International Criminal Court. And of course, Russia is not only opposing accountability efforts, it is also actively participating in the crimes as an ally of the Syrian regime. So that's one issue. Secondly, of course, there are the intricacies of the conflict with international, internal, and regional dimensions. And when we look at the civil war, this was really caused principally by the regime's determination to resort to every form of violence to crush contestation. And thus it transformed the original protest movement that was peaceful into violent conflict. And what we saw, of course, were hostilities between the regime and violent jihadi groups, with increasing international involvement by Russia and Iran backing the regime on the one hand, and then Gulf states and Turkey backing the rebel groups on the other hand.
And then maybe at this junction, could you tell us about the emergence of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or Daesh as it's more commonly known?
Well, the emergence of ISIS in 2014 really changed the nature of the conflict and turned it into an international conflict. It has led to the US-led military intervention with airstrikes in Syria and Iraq. And then lastly, of course, we also have the Turkish invasion and the occupation of large parts of northern Syria since 2016. So this entails a high level of complexity along with terrible violence by a growing number of perpetrators. And this has led to a complexity that prompted a kind of Syria fatigue, where people are disinterested in the conflict and turn their gaze away.
I mean, this is indeed a very complex and almost impossible to capture and explain in just a few sentences, although I think you did a wonderful job at it. But another thing that we seem to see here is that the emergence of ISIS was one of the major turning points in this conflict. It seems to have led to a shifting narrative in media and policy circles from the Assad regime as the main perpetrator of international crimes to the regime that has to fight a violent jihadist group. So how did this turn affect the international mobilization for justice?
Well, mainly it got the regime off the hook and it entrenched a tendency of creeping impunity. And this tendency already manifested itself in 2013 when the regime got away with the use of chemical weapons for the first time and started to demographically re-engineer the country through annihilation policies, and it didn't have to pay an important price. Then, of course, the horrific violence of ISIS and the real security threat that it also poses in the global north made it much easier to forget that the regime is responsible for the majority of the crimes. And of course, this has led to a de facto, I would say, acceptance of the regime, even if it's a reluctant one, that there is no perspective of a transition anytime soon.
This is indeed a very worrying phenomenon, also coupled with that creeping impunity you described.
What makes matters worse, of course, is the regime's successful strategy of disinformation along with Russia that helps it there. I refer to it as narrative warfare, and it aims at discrediting the evidence of crimes and also the narratives of opposition leaders and activists. We saw this again in the case of the use of chemical weapons, where the regime decided to pass on the responsibility to opposition groups and Daesh and deny flatly that it had any responsibility. So the effects of narrative warfare and the Syria fatigue really pushed the experiences of victims to the background, and it somehow made these injustices abstract, as if they don't pertain to this world.
And I mean, if we think about it, the bare numbers itself are just shocking. We're looking at over 500,000 Syrians who have been killed, 12 million who have been displaced, and 130,000 who have been forcibly disappeared. It seems as if these numbers no longer touch us as much as they used to, and rather they make victims fade away. So in your article, you argue that the Syrian conflict is the perfect example of the way in which international crimes are erased and invisibilized. So what's the difference between these two phenomena, and why is this so relevant in the Syrian context?
Well, I think to understand erasure and invisibilization in the Syrian context, we really need to understand the paradox between the very high level of documentation on the one hand, and then the scant, I would almost say, non-existent formal avenues of justice on the other hand. So the evidence of atrocity crimes is really staggering. Just to focus on one example of solid evidence, we have the Caesar files, which is an archive of a military defector that proved that over 6,000 detainees died in torture. The files provide the evidence for investigations, such as the current universal jurisdiction trial in Germany that specifically focuses on state torture, the so-called Al-Khatib trial.
Now, just to give some background here for those who may not be as familiar, the Al-Khatib trial, called after a detention facility in Damascus against two former Syrian security service officials, started in Koblenz in Germany in April 2020.
Yes, indeed. And it led to the conviction of Iyad R for crimes against humanity, one defendant, and he was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison. The trial against the other defendant, Anwar R, accused of the torture of at least 4,000 people in the beginning of the uprising in the Al-Khatib detention center, is ongoing. And of course, the trial is a milestone because it's a shift away from the almost exclusive focus that we've seen on jihadi perpetrators in most of the universal jurisdiction cases. And in our article, we recognized this. Yet at the same time, we also saw that the debates around the trial made us thinking about the danger of erasure and invisibilization. And erasure we define as a process in which acts and choices of actors result in a narrowing of justice narratives by excluding certain very important voices or certain topics. In the case of invisibilization, there is no specific actor, such as in the case of erasure, but it's a gradual process of marginalization. To start with the latter, for example, in the Syrian context, we see that sexual and gender-based violence for a long time was absent from the dominant justice narrative, so a clear case of invisibilization. When we look into torture, it might be a bit strange to state this, but torture has been highlighted very much. And of course, a result of the fact that it's an relatively easy crime to investigate and prosecute because of the vast amount of evidence by transnational groups of justice actors, victim groups, NGOs, but also formal institutions such as the IIIM. But conversely, if we look, for example, at the use of chemical weapons or the bombardments of civilian infrastructure such as hospitals, these crimes were initially not addressed at all in universal jurisdiction cases because of the lack of willingness and also the lack of legal tools to prosecute these crimes. So it's very important to address these crimes because else they risk disappearing from the justice debate.
Mm-hmm. And to link this to a concrete case, you wanted to zoom in on forcible disappearances and kidnappings. And you spoke about this topic to Yasmin Feda, director of the documentary at Uni, a few days ago. And as Yasmin highlights in this fragment, these practices have a far-reaching impact.
I think it's like as an act of war, like a war crime, I think it's a very, let's say, efficient way to silence critics because it both silences the person that's been targeted, but it can also have a numbing effect on their family members or loved ones or networks they were part of. Because I think, particularly in the case of Syria, there's just so many different layers of fear and complexity around how you deal with different kinds of situations like this. The first layer of difficulty is, can you negotiate or find anything out about them? And families are sometimes scared to speak up about what's happened to them in case it affects what happens to their loved one during their disappearance. So it kind of numbs people.
What is so terrible here is that people revolted against the regime and hoped that the walls of fear would crumble. And Mariam Hala confirms Yasmin's words. Breaking down the fear of the regime continues really to be one of the most important challenges. A couple of days ago, I phoned her in Berlin and we spoke in Arabic. And you will hear Mariam's voice in Arabic because it's important to have her voice in the episode. And I asked Maisa Tanjour to do the voiceover in English.
And we just wanted to add here that for the Arabic speakers among our listeners, we will make sure that the conversation between Mariam and Brigitte is available on our website. Let's listen now to Mariam, who talks about the importance of breaking down that fear.
Fear to tell your story. Even as we live in Europe, there are many families who are afraid to tell their stories. Because so far, some of their members are in Syria. And we know that the regime can arrest anyone arbitrarily without any justification. The first thing we need to get rid of is this fear. We need to erase this fear from the hearts of people, especially those outside Syria. Everyone must tell their stories. All the people should tell their stories. All the victims and all the survivors must tell their stories to the whole world so that they can make a kind of narrative, a Syrian narrative to the whole world so that the world becomes the one who works onto reaching, as we say, the decision makers, which is a kind of pressure on them.
Mariam clearly explains that victims are not only exposed to the chilling effect of war crimes, but the lack of criminal accountability comes on top of that. And then it's also impossible in a lot of cases to find the truth about what happened to their loved ones. And even when they get the confirmation that that person died, often through false and forged death certificates by the regime, in many cases they are left without a body. And this causes tremendous pain. And Mariam talks about the search for her son, Ayham, and how she lived that. And for some listeners, it might be quite distressing to hear these details.
Waiting began with the arrest of Ayham. Of course, he had been detained for 3 months previously. The second arrest was on 5th of November, 2012. He was arrested at Damascus University, as friends told us that he was arrested at the university. We waited for 3 months. I wasn't always waiting at home, I was always looking for him. We kept looking for him for 3 months until a younger prisoner was released. He was the one who documented everything that happened, the torture, how he died in his company. So he told me that he died. We organized the morning gathering according to traditions. At this stage, the wait had stopped because the end is now known. But 10 days later, different news came to us by one of those who had been arrested. He was a distant relative who came out and told us that Ayham was still alive and that he spoke to him. So I entered a phase where I only wanted to know the truth and whether Ayham was alive or dead. For 17 months, that's a year and 5 months, I kept looking for him every day. I searched for him. Is he alive or dead? I didn't care if he was arrested or not. My concern was to find the truth wherever possible. I tried with the highest authorities, but to no avail. The daily waiting continued for 17 months until they gave me his death certificate, a death certificate which says he died 5 days after his arrest. All this search was in vain. All this waiting was in vain. I took the certificate, but there was no certainty. I didn't receive his body. I didn't know how he died. I didn't know anything about him. After about 6 months, I tried to see where his belongings were buried. I was able to obtain a paper from the military judiciary saying that he died in one of the security branches with body number 320 on the same date that was mentioned. That's 5 days after the arrest. Also, like what I said, the security officers followed us and we got out of the house where we sought refuge. So we fled to Lebanon. In Lebanon, the waiting continued. There was still hope because I didn't see him. I didn't bury him. I didn't see his body. So I remained hopeful until then. Even if the hope was just 5 in 1 million. Until Caesar's photos appeared, his picture was clear. He died 5 days after arrest. It's clear. This means our waiting has stopped. But this waiting lasted 2 years from the day he was arrested, during which I searched and waited on a daily basis. Of course, we've been subjected to extortion. People taken advantage of your desire to know the truth. This was very difficult because they would come to tell you that they know something in exchange for money. The situation was very difficult. I don't know what to say. I hope that waiting will stop for all the families and the detainees will be set free, inshallah. They will all return to their families alive.
So the issue of waiting and just not knowing, it must be excruciating.
Yeah, indeed. And that's why people take matters in their own hands, because very little is done at the international level. And Mariam explains how she founded the Caesar Families Association because she wanted to join forces with other families and do advocacy work among others. But often policymakers were incapable of doing more than listening. They were affected by the stories of the survivors and the families, but they were often unable to help out. Together with four other victim groups, they launched the Charter for Truth and Justice in 2021, so last February, because they wanted to weigh on the political agenda. And one of their concrete demands is the establishment of a mechanism for the forcibly disappeared and the missing.
We formed a coalition under the name of Charter for Justice and the Truth to retain the independence of each association that works on its own. The charter was established on 10th of February 2021. Afterwards, we raised the issue of work mechanism. We, the Caesar Families Association, are interested in the mechanism, which allow international community groups approved by the Security Council, the European Union, or the General Assembly to enter Syria because the Syrian regime prevents any organization from entering Syria. They need to focus only on revealing the fate of the missing. We don't want to determine who the perpetrators are. We don't want to hold anyone accountable, but we just want to know the fate of those who have been missing for 10 years. What happened to them? Who is alive and who is dead? The idea of revealing and the mechanism itself would be humanitarian. Of course, we won't forget that we want to hold the perpetrators accountable, and we won't forget that we're asking for compensation, whether moral or material, for the families, for all Syrian families who lost their possessions and children.
So this is really interesting how victim groups set their priorities in the absence of formal or criminal accountability avenues. They indicate that the search for the truth prevails now. They seem to refuse passivity, just like Yasmin explains here, that you need to find a way to hold on to the truth, also to make future efforts happen.
Something I realized as I was working on this is in the case, researching forcible disappearance on the ground or forensically was basically impossible. It was not an option, and it still is not an option for many families. So the only way to kind of tackle it or to look into it was emotionally and through people's stories. And therefore, it's really important. There will become a time in the future that forensic kind of research will be possible on the ground, you know, whether it's mass graves or where people have been held. But that work is yet to happen, really. And in the meantime, I think it's really important to still gather those stories as evidence of the lives that have been disappeared.
Yeah, for Yasmin, it was really important to make sure that these stories are not forgotten. And that's why she made her documentary, because she personally knew Basil and Paolo. And it was important to have their voices in the current conversation.
Although it's not necessarily a word, presencing was definitely an important thing in making this project. It was very much to bring the voices and a limited, you know, experience of Basil and Paolo on screen. And I think that's what film particularly can do, because we can hear people in their own voice. You know, we're not just reading about them, but we're sort of spending time with them. And I think that's a form of making them present. And through that, to understand their absence. So, you know, film is really good in presencing people. And I think it's important because, particularly in the case of Father Paolo and Basil Safadi, is they sort of became symbols as well after their kidnappings and disappearances. They became like an image of the revolution in some cases. And although that's a positive thing, at the same time, it sort of takes away their actual voice. You know, they just become a picture. And I think that's where film can come in and sort of bring their presence back, because we're actually hearing their voices, we're actually feeling their emotions and living with them for a while. I realized after a while, by making them present, when they become absent in the present tense of the film, we start to understand what it feels for the families a little bit. So I think that was also important. So to not just talk about them in the past, but to talk about them in their present, kind of in film time. I think it's just important also to highlight like some of the stories of those who've been disappeared. Obviously, there's thousands and thousands more, but Basil and Paolo are two examples of people who were targeted. So I think it's important to consistently remember that, because I think in the efforts for justice, it's important to remember the stories of who's actually been disappeared.
Now, with that in mind, I think I would like to ask you one final question, Brigitte, about your future perspectives. So what can we do when formal justice avenues are as absent as they are in Syria? Can these stories play a role in opening up the justice imagination for Syrians?
Yes, I do think actually that these stories really play a role in opening up the justice imagination and making people think and look differently at what justice could look like concretely. And I do share that optimism of the will, if you want, with a lot of international and Syrian justice actors. Because the fact that the justice architecture fails currently really makes us move away from defining justice and accountability solely in relation to existing judicial mechanisms, because these are very limited. And currently we see this move towards stretching the boundaries of the justice debate. And this is, of course, what happens with the victim groups. And also creative justice efforts are imposing themselves out of necessity. And we saw this in the past also, for example, with memorialization in Lebanon and in other places, that creative justice efforts are needed when there's very scant formal justice avenues. And this also happens to counter what Hannah Arendt called the holes of oblivion. And in the Syrian case, this has materialized itself, for example, in a sequenced approach that the victim groups of the Charter for Truth and Justice have advanced, because as victims and survivors, they really want to shape the responses towards the justice issues in a way that affects them and their loved ones, and they want to counter the attempts, of course, to silence them.
At the same time, the victim groups seem very clear about the fact that these current efforts are only providing a modicum of justice, that this is what needs to happen now, but more is clearly needed.
When we look back at 2011, when the uprising started, transitional justice was embraced as a way to overcome this justice impasse in the kingdom of silence, as Syria was called. And people were very optimistic about the possibilities to implement a transitional justice paradigm with the four pillars, and had very, optimistic ideas about how this could take place on the ground. Of course, currently we see that only some elements and little elements of the toolkit are being tested. And of course, there's a strong deception among civil society activists what transitional justice could mean in the context of ongoing war crimes, and also, of course, in the context of a non-transition that is currently entrenched. Currently, we are really in the midst of something new, a new development towards more activism of victims in the pursuit of justice. And this is a shift, I think, because it alters the debate. And it shows that victims will always seek a way to forbid forgetting and to pave the way for future efforts.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Brigitte. It's shocking that it's been 10 years already, but it's actually really enlightening and a bit hopeful to hear that this is the new direction that we're taking, and that victims are making sure that we'd never forget, basically. So thank you for sharing that with us again. And in our next episode, we are going to talk about temporality and Chile with our colleague Marit, so we look forward to you joining us. This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.